Support for this podcast comes from Outdoor Supply Hardware, inviting listeners to Osh's big anniversary sale celebration, May 20th through the 26th, featuring daily deals, $15,000 in giveaways, 20% off store-wide on Saturday and Sunday, and a lot more. Learn more at osh.com.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Ilya Ponomarenko has become one of Ukraine's best-known journalists, drawing more than a million followers on X, formerly Twitter, with his first-hand accounts of Russia's attack on Kyiv in February of 2022. His tweets of Ukraine's resolve on the battlefield, his personal reflections, and dark humor have become the basis of his new book called I Will Show You How It Was. Life during the Battle of Kyiv, he writes, was a bizarre mixture of inconceivable inspiration, unity, and pride. It's that spirit, Ponomarenko says, Ukraine needs now more than ever after more than 2 years of relentless fighting. He joins us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Ilya Ponomarenko was 29 years old when Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24, 2022. A journalist for the Kyiv Independent, a paper he'd just co-founded, Ponomarenko's on-the-ground reporting of the Battle of Kyiv quickly drew an international audience, leading one German media outlet in 2023 to call him likely the best-known Ukrainian after President Volodymyr Zelensky. Ponomarenko's new book, I Will Show You How It Was, is his first-hand account of the invasion, following combat teams and standing with civilians committed to defending their homeland. Ilya Ponomarenko joins me now from Bucha. Welcome to Forum, Ilya.
Hello, thank you.
So you turned 30 shortly after the invasion, and you write in your book, if you think about it, a Ukrainian 30 years of age has spent one-third of his or her life amid Russia's war on their homeland. You're talking about since around 2014 when Putin seized Crimea. So how has that shaped the way you feel about Ukraine, your relationship to your country, even before the attack in 2022?
It's true that in many ways, this war that continues for more than a decade now, since the days of 2014, when Russia seized Crimea and also instigated an insurrection in eastern Ukraine that left two Ukrainian cities under Russian occupation and Russian control, which continues up to this day. In many ways, that was the moment, the outbreak of these wars as a revenge of Russia for the year of Maidan Revolution. In many ways, that was the starting point of a very new country and a very new nation that started this. It was the beginning of Ukraine absolutely transforming itself into something absolutely different, into a absolutely pro-European nation, into a nation that changes so rapidly for the better. And as a nation who has this, you know, this constant struggle within to become a better place. And we, a younger generation, active citizen, we were in many ways the author of this. Hmm. We were students or school students who organized rallies across Ukraine in the days of Euromaidan. Your school was in Mariupol kicking up this. So in many ways, that was the beginning of our country that is ours to make. And it became more than just, you know, political reforms or defense reforms or something like that. It was about the thing that we do with our lives, something that we do for our lifetime.
Yeah, you describe many in your generation as open to the world around you, more oriented toward the West and the West's ideals, unlike previous generations. What was the difference between, say, your mom's generation, your parents' generation, you write about your mom, and yours with regard to how they viewed the nation and what they wanted from their leaders?
It's true that we are really different. We're really different from our generation, our fathers and mothers. The thing is that, it's been 3 decades since the fall of the Soviet Union, and our generation, especially in the wake of pro-European, pro-Western governments that emerged following the so-called Orange Revolution in 2014 and 2005, we grew up listening to many things like European integration, rule of law, just political system, competitive political system, democracy, the rule of people over the state, and not vice versa. And in addition to that, we were more open to Western culture, Western way of life, habits, so many things that are absolutely normal and natural for people in the West, for Western lifestyle. It can go down to very simple details of life, such as the view of the ways to reach prosperity, in pursuit of happiness in here. When it comes to my generation, in broad terms, it's about, making a career, moving to Kiev from some small town, starting from nothing, getting education, getting better in life, and, earning your position in this country, earning your wealth and your prosperity with your hard labor and hard work. When it comes to the generation of our parents, it's not 100% true in all cases. Like, it's not absolute, but still, that generation grew up in a system that does not encourage enthusiasm, does not encourage your personal business activities, for instance. They grew up in a system that says that no matter how hard you work, it's not for you to decide on your future. No matter how hard you work, it does not really depend on you, your position in this in your society and your personal prosperity. The state is dominant over you. It has the right to enforce things on you. It has the right to tell you what to think. And to us, in many ways, that was absolutely unacceptable. It was 100% opposite of what we grew up having on our minds. So in many ways, that difference precipitated the Euromaidan revolution, because we did not agree with the then state, the government, telling us that we cannot sign a rapprochement agreement with the European Union and go farther towards the West. We did not agree with this. So it goes to so many details about this. But and I say that, shift of generation, it really shapes this country for the better. I keep saying this, even in on my memory, the country of Ukraine from, let's say, 10 years ago is absolutely different from the country of today. And today's country is the country that I like most.
And when you talk about the Maidan Revolution, you're talking about ultimately those demonstrations that unseated Viktor Yanukovych. I also know that you said your mom was openly pro-Russian before the invasion. How did she express this?
It's true for many, many people in my home region in East Ukraine. And it's not because, these people are evil or something like that.
No,
It's
no.
nothing like that. It's because of a lot of economic, social reasons, a lot of problems that Ukraine had and has, a lot of things that happened because of the soft, firstly soft, and then harsh Russian intervention, and promoting its image as a wealthy, much more stable country than Ukraine, as something, as a force that can come and, give you things for free with no little to no labor from your side. So naturally, a lot of people who were poorer than they could have been in Ukraine, they were naturally thinking about Russia as the as the beacon of more prosperity, better life, better perspective, more political stability, as something that is closer to them mentally and economically too, because a lot of businesses, a lot of industries in my part of Ukraine also dependent on economic ties with Russia,
Right.
which is sort of a legacy from Soviet Union. So it was the in many ways that was image taken from the way Russia presented itself on its TV for foreigners,
Yes.
for Eastern Ukrainians. So, for instance, and that goes also to your close ones, because they think about Russia as the country with more incomes, bigger salaries, bigger opportunities, more comfort. So that's the way they were thinking about this. In many
Yeah.
ways, that's the problems of Ukraine too. But Russia exploited these problems for something that ended up being a terrible, unspeakable tragedy and disaster for our region.
Yeah, I was struck by how you describe those 10 years after the unseating of Yanukovych as Ukraine fighting on two fronts, a military one against Russia and an internal one among its citizens. In terms of the ideals of the your generation's revolution in the West and the concern about losing ties with Russia as well. Then, of course, all of that changed on February 24th, as you say about your mother. You say the world turned upside down, bringing a torment of bitter regrets. We're just about to come up onto a break, but I'm wondering what you meant by that, a torment of bitter regrets. Was this something that your mother expressed?
I'm afraid it's a yes. It's a definitely a yes, because imagine this shock that after, let's say, years of having high hopes on Russia, of trusting what Russia says about itself on TV, after years of thinking about that, after years of also sometimes even decrying people like me who were openly standing against Russia and telling everybody that it's a deal with the devil. Russia is no friend to us. It's not going to end well. All these things that were happening within the Russian-occupied Donetsk, the thing that happened to this once prosperous city that turned into criminal enclave under Russian occupation. Of course, and moreover, the pictures of absolutely horrible devastation of cities like Mariupol, of our
Yes.
own home city, which turned into rubble and mass graves within days. Of course, as people say, those who have eyes will see. And many people, unfortunately, saw this, what happened following the invasion. And it was a pure shock, pure horror, and the source of bitter regrets of war things that were happening in the past.
We're
Harsh
talking
reality.
harsh realities. Yeah. We're talking with Ilya Ponomarenko, a journalist and author of the new book, I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv. And after the break, we will recount those early days of the invasion in 2022. You, our listeners, are invited to join the conversation. What would you like to ask or tell Ilya? Did you follow him on Twitter? Do you follow him now? Did his reporting play a role in your understanding of the invasion? The email address is forum@kqed.org. Our social channels are at KQED Forum. Our phone number 866-733-6786.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, Ilya Ponomarenko's on-the-ground reporting quickly captured an international audience. Ponomarenko's new book, I Will Show You How It Was, provides a first-person account of the Battle of Kyiv and its impact on everyday Ukrainians, and especially on his generation. You can join the conversation with your thoughts and reflections about that time. Questions for Ilya. Are you a survivor yourself of war? Email forum@kqed.org. Call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Find us on our social channels at KQED Forum on X or Instagram. Our digital community is Discord. So, Ilya, when you heard those first missile strikes on Kyiv, what did you think? Did you think you were on the verge of losing your country?
That was the understanding that came not in just one moment, but it was a long process, I must say. And I tried to carefully describe this transition from being absolutely defiant, absolutely denying the possibility of full-scale Russian invasion because of many reasonable reasons, as we call it, and this transition to slowly accepting that is going to happen, no matter how absurd and horrible it sounds, it's going to happen. And then switching to doing things, doing what had to be done in there. When I first heard the booms of incoming missiles, I was personally absolutely prepared for the fact that it's going to be a terrible battle. We cannot predict what's coming next, but what we were prepared for is that we're going to do what needs to be done. We will be doing our duty, be what may. We wanted to do what we wanted to be is the subject of honor. We wanted to be not ashamed of ourselves. So the military, journalists, regular people, active citizens, it was the understanding that's going to happen, and we were ready. We were ready. When it comes to our chances, on that night, I stayed sleepless. We, as journalists, we already knew that it's going to happen at either 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. Everything seemed to be more or less prepared. We had absolute confidence about our military. We had confidence about our leadership that seemed to be ready to take up the fight, despite our huge criticism of the way they prepared. And I expected that it's going to be a terrible battle in which extremely brutal and long, prolonged guerrilla war against Russian occupation. And in the end, after a certain period of time, end up being an absolutely unwinnable war for Russia that will be so exhausted, so pressured by the international community that it would have to lose ground and gradually withdraw. Something that could be compared to what happened eventually in Vietnam with the United States or in Iraq in many ways. I expected something of like that to happen. In reality proved to be somewhat different in a positive way, I must say. When I was getting back to Kyiv after taking care of my loved ones, I was getting back with my friends, and I was thinking of nothing but a chance to see the Battle of Kyiv, to participate in the defense of my capital city, of my beloved city. I was thinking about the fact that probably if we are lucky, we'll stay alive, we'll be as careful as possible, we'll be sticking to our friends, and maybe if we are lucky, we'll be able to flee before it's too late and save our lives and to go and to fight another day to, you know, continue serving our country at our places. So this is what I was thinking about. I thought we had a chance. I was absolutely sure that Ukraine will fight till the bitter end. And with the, you know, general defeat is not going to be the end. And eventually we will outwear Russia and make it flee. But at the same time, there was this thought, there was this understanding that this country will be in shambles and in ruins. That's going to be a terrible tragedy, of course. We had no illusions about this.
Yes. Well, your on-the-ground reporting, which was documented mainly on then Twitter, it went from a few thousand followers to hundreds of thousands to quickly more than a million as you were sharing your tweets. Were you shocked? How did it affect your work, your life, to see that kind of reaction from the international community to what you were putting out there?
I can't say I was like shocked, like genuinely shocked. The first weeks of the invasion, especially when it comes to the first days of the invasion, was so full of work, of this insanely energized drive, insanely energized anticipation and enthusiasm too, and inspiration and hatred. And so many emotions, so much energy put into this. So we were working like robotic in wartime mode. We had plans when it comes to our personal security and behavior, when it comes to the way to keep the news organization working in the flood and things like that. We had maybe a couple of hours of sleep at best. And when it comes to the first hours of the invasion, we had little to no sleep. I think I was sleepless for like 60 hours in a row. So it was about being absolutely involved in this with 100% of your mental capabilities. And many things were happening as they were. Many things were not surprising. And we didn't have any certain like plan of coverage or something like that. We were doing this from the depth of our hearts, sometimes not in an ideal way, sometimes in a very emotional way, especially when it comes to social media too. Or yeah, lots of F words too, lots of emotion too. And I must say that in many ways, this humane, this simple approach, way of describing our emotions too, and things that happen behind the headlines. It in many ways it worked. It really worked. This is why I and many other people who were in Ukraine or reported about Ukraine gained so much attention because of this humane approach. And naturally, there was this understanding that we are in the middle of a significant historical event, and this is something very unique in modern history. And we are seem to be doing a good job in this. At least we were happy about, our role in this. Yeah, you can you post your work. You struggle between the emotions just boiling inside your brain and the need to stay focused, to stay reasonable, to not talk nonsense online or in your stories to keep the organization afloat. And it goes on and on like a snowball. I actually recently checked. I think I reached the point of 1 million on this second week following the invasion. So basically it was like maybe 10 days or so. So it's just because of this unique nature of this event of full scale, the biggest European war since World War II. And also because of this very dedicated work that we were doing. And obviously, because of a lot of emotions in the our day and age of social media, where everyone get a voice.
It was definitely the personal things you shared that made your profile resonate, but also the fact that you were not a foreign war correspondent coming in to cover this. Not that that effort isn't heroic, but a Ukrainian whose own hometown has been leveled, who's defending their own capital city. It creates a different level of connection to what is going on. You also say you used it to counter Russian rhetoric because there was a lot of essentially fake news or rhetoric that was coming out that was shaping, trying to shape the hearts and minds of the international community, or maybe the minds.
This was especially true in the first days of the invasion, but also in the last days before the invasion, because it didn't just start in a snap. Russians spent several days ridiculously staging like a pretext for the war, pretending that Ukraine is about to attack Russia, pretending that Ukraine is unfolding a sort of a genocidal war in my home region, and not being really good at this. Hand on heart, I'm saying this not because I'm Ukrainian, because life from that perspective, that was so lame, so ridiculous, so far-fetched. It was always laughable. For instance, in incidents like Russia obviously staging the attack of two Ukrainian armored vehicles inside Russia, inside the entire Russia, and simply having two broken vehicles, just setting them on fire and bringing their propagandists to film some sort of a video for Russian TV saying that two Ukrainian armored vehicles has just attacked Russian territory and they were destroyed on March. And this hysterical mass evacuation of Donbass civilians on the pretext of saving them from Ukrainian genocide, with thousands of people on TV cameras, in front of TV cameras, put on buses and driven towards the Russian border or to the Russian territory, and then put out in the middle of nowhere just for the sake of TV picture. You know, I can talk about this for hours, but it was obvious that they are making the steps to present, to prepare some sort of media ground for actual invasion, for actual war. They are looking for a reason to invade. They have made the decision and they just created a media picture. And they are, frankly, we're not being good at this. But at the same time, you understand this and you are boiling inside. You see what they are doing. And you gradually switch to this awful realization that no matter how dumb it is, no matter how absurd it is, they're actually doing this. And this means war, actual war. And we were really trying to counter all those things with a pretty emotional outcries on social media. I remember myself, for instance, during this hysterical so-called evacuation of civilians from occupied Donbass into Russia to save them from Ukrainian genocide, that was absolutely not happening. I remember just leaving my office and going to the subway, taking the train, and seeing lots of people in subway just checking the news on their smartphones. Almost everybody was checking the news because everybody, many people were expecting Russians to actually do some sort of provocation that would trigger their enforced response against Ukraine. And I remember just writing a message in caps lock saying that anything that happens in that would probably give a pretext for Russian invasion of Ukraine, like a provocation, terror attack, attack on civilians, something like that, is very likely a staged provocation to start a war against Ukraine. Do not buy this. Do not trust the aggressor trying to get a good face in the wake of the biggest war since World War II.
Yeah.
Just a simple message, but just an outcry from deep inside your heart.
Ilya, you are speaking to me from Bucha now, and sadly, that city's name is well known to me and others in the world because it has been a site of horrific atrocities. It was a site of horrific atrocities in the early weeks of the war, and you were one of the first groups of journalists to enter Bucha after the Russian retreat. Can you talk about what you saw there? And I do want to warn listeners that this description may be disturbing, but just give us a sense, because you described it as a hellscape.
This was a sort of this was something that could be compared to a levee that breaks. And immediately as Russians were confirmed to have left the Bucha area and many other areas of Kiev region, the military and the police started entering those regions, and Like I said, it's a levee that was broken, and journalists immediately rushed following them. So it was not that we were doing this under military control or something like that, that some Russian propagandists were saying. You can't stop like literally thousands of journalists from around the world simply defying any rules and entering the newly occupied areas to see what does it look like. We did see bodies, a lot of bodies in the streets, lying in the streets. I personally remember a lot of killed dogs just lying in the streets. A lot of bodies in basements, just by sides of streets. Lots of devastated houses in terms of being, in terms of their, in terms of the facts of being robbed.
Yeah.
Lots of robbed apartments, mass graves next to churches too. Crosses, like makeshift crosses made of wood planks, put on improvised graves on parking lots, because in the middle of hostilities, local civilians who were hiding in basements, they couldn't get a proper burial, so they would do this for their people next door who were killed, just on parking lots, just next to supermarkets. By the way, a lot of supermarkets devastated and robbed and marauded. Also, this smell, this atmosphere that was absolutely grim. I remember this very vividly, because it's not about the smell, it's not about the flavor, it's not about something that could be sensed, but you could feel this, the atmosphere of rot. It's something that bears the touch of evil. Something really evil happened in those places. It's really hard to describe. It's something, you know, and the weather was rather nasty and really gray. It was fearsome. It had this touch of evil in there.
Yeah, and on the way you describe, well, you write, try to imagine seeing a grave hastily dug in the parking lot of the Walmart, the one that you've driven to millions of times, the one that's part of your life's everyday errands, the one at which you'd never expect to see anything other than your neighbors messing around with shopping carts at their car trunk. Such a rapid intrusion of mass death into the beautiful routine of everyone's life is one of the most unspeakably horrifying things one can witness. We're talking about Ilya Ponomarenko's new book, I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv, this hour. And this listener writes, I'd like to express my gratitude to Ilya. I used to check his feed almost hourly to get the latest on the war and appreciated his accuracy, honesty, and bravery. If you also followed Ilya on Twitter, especially as his reporting of those early days of the invasion, if it played a role in your understanding of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, you can share that, as well as any questions or reflections you have for him. Questions also you have about where things are now in Ukraine and how Ukrainians are feeling about the war moving forward. The email address is forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels @KQED Forum. We're on Twitter or X, Instagram. Our digital community is Discord. Our phone number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Ilya Ponomarenko this hour, a journalist and author of I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv, about the months leading to and immediately following Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Recently, Ponomarenko wrote in Time, "In victories and setbacks, here we are now, an independent nation in control of 80% of our sovereign territory, mourning our dead, sending our gratitude to friends, and grasping at any straw to carry on. We survive as a nation thanks to that moral choice of doing what is right." This listener tweets, "When this $61 billion is spent," this was the allocation from the U.S. recently, "what's next? What's the endgame? Americans have our own problems. And for millions of us, Ukraine is last on the list." What effect did it have on you when we in the U.S. and a faction of Republicans in our Congress were delaying additional funding to Ukraine?
Well, of course, I cannot help but admit that was a lot of dissatisfaction here in Ukraine, a lot of unhappiness and being upset about the role of the United States in general, about the United States' role as a partner and a friend and a backer in need that we thought is 100% behind our back, because we spent months, many months of this war, thinking of anything but the possibility of the United States dropping this bipartisan support of Ukraine, in especially when it comes to the United States Congress. We were so absolutely sure about this process being absolutely guaranteed, that was quite a bit of a shock, I must say. Especially given the fact that Ukraine is a very emotional country. Let's call it this way, in this time. So I must say, regrettably, this it's not good to be something of a surprise, but regrettably, the image of United States leadership has had a lot of damage here in Ukraine.
This listener writes, "If Trump wins, he will pull funding for Ukraine, making it difficult, if not impossible, for Ukraine to win and easier for Putin to win. Do you think Putin is thinking about this dangling possibility? How much does your guest think the outcome of our presidential election is affecting Putin's strategy? What do you think about a Trump victory and its potential impact on Ukraine?"
Well, when it comes to Russian thinking about this, I give you 100% guarantee, even though I do not sit in the Kremlin, but knowing these people, knowing the mindset of those people.
Of the government, you mean?
Of the Kremlin.
Of the Kremlin, yes.
Of the Russian leadership, knowing the way these people think, I give you 100% guarantee that it was something the victory of president of probably next President Trump, it was their bet. This is something that they perceive as the something that delivers them. It's something that sort of a silver bullet for this war. I give you 100% guarantee that this is something that they have been thinking about, and they praying on this every single day. And one of the things that is very natural for Vladimir Putin in particular is that he always believes in this messianic role of himself, and also this sort of a lucky star that shines over him throughout all of his career. There was always something that turns up and saves the day for him. For so many years, and he definitely 100% believes that Donald Trump is something as a silver bullet. He will simply give him Ukraine on the plate with little to nothing. But to be honest, and especially in the wake of what eventually happened to the United States Congress and this defense aid bill, I would not be so sure about this.
Interesting.
Putin really spreads this. He puts a lot of hope on withdrawal of the United States, and in general on the withdrawal of the West out of these questions, on so many pretexts ranging from Ukraine is not our problem, or we have our own problems, so we didn't have money and it's not our issue. So essentially, this is something that is the only realistic and guaranteed chance for Russia to defeat Ukraine and to reach 100% of their goal in Ukraine, so that West turns away and does nothing essentially to help Ukraine. So, the complexity, I wouldn't be this sure, because hand on heart, when you know presidential races, when presidential races stop, and when things switch to actual things on the ground and actual politics to be made, it's a pretty different from faraway rhetorics, a lot of hot air. It's about real. So we'll see.
Let me read this comment from Noel, on Discord. Noel writes, "How can the war be ended? All wars eventually are negotiated. What should be on the table?" I'm not saying that Noel is saying this, but people in the West have called for an end to the war, to negotiate territories, to give up, et cetera, to bring this to an end. What is your response to that?
Of course, the people in the West and the people in Ukraine are absolutely united in the willingness to bring this war to an end, be it negotiations, be it anything, but to bring this war to an end. Problem is that we in Ukraine do not really have an option of, you know, negotiating the end of this war and a good peace for us. It's just not something that's on the plate. For us, not because we are so ignorant and so stupid, and not because President Zelensky doesn't want this war to end so that he loses power. It's just because Russia does not this war to end. Not in the present condition, unless the 100% of Ukraine is seized and Ukraine ceases to exist as an independent nation. It's not about certain territories or certain city under Russian control, or certain region under Russian control. This is not the option of stopping this war to make Ukraine, you know, cede territories, a sort of compromise, and simply bring this to an end forever. We would be first to negotiate. We would be first to stop this terrible loss of life for our best men and women, of course. But the problem is that the other side doesn't want this. And when it comes to negotiations, and when it comes to the way to end this war, the only possible way, whether someone likes it or not, to end this war is to disable Russia from going on with this war, and economically, politically, militarily. So the only way is to make them stop.
The only option is to fight to the bitter end, essentially. I want to read something that you wrote in The Atlantic about what you think the West and even Western media fails to appreciate. 10 years of confrontation with the Kremlin, you write, and especially the past 2 years of Russia's full-scale invasion, have fundamentally changed Ukraine. And also, you say, today Russia is a neo-Stalinist dictatorship led by an aging chauvinist. In the grip of his messianic delusion, Putin initiated the biggest European war since World War II. He seeks to eliminate Ukraine, not only as an independent nation, but also as an idea. No concessions or compromises are possible with such a vision, not given the kind of country Ukrainians have made and fought to defend. Ilya, I want to ask you, you talked about the incredible resolve, optimism, an intensity of the revolution's ideals for young people in around 2013, 2014. What does this look like now for your generation? I know it's still too early to fully comprehend the impact that these last couple of years of war have had on your generation, but do you worry about the scars that this war is leaving?
Oh, of course. It's larger than life. Actually, when it comes to the young generation and future generations, this is one of the subjects that we often think about in our public discourse in Ukraine, the future of our generation, the next generations, because we, by the beginning of this war, we were in a pretty bad demographic situation in which the generation that ranges from, let's say, 25 years old to, let's say, 35 years old is the less numerous in this country. Because in many ways, because of the turmoils of 1990s and the fall of the Soviet Union, so there are not that many young people in this country, in Ukraine. And so this is, by the way, one of the reasons why the average age of a conscripted soldier here in Ukraine is around 40, 45, even 50. It's partly because of this policy of trying to preserve the younger generation. For instance, right now, only males older than 25 are eligible for mobilization. And that's a change because it used to be eligibility age started from 27 years old. So, of course, that's a terrible future. Moreover, we know that roughly 10 million Ukrainians have fled this country. And we can't be sure and we can't know how many of them would get back to this country for economic activities when the war is over, for reconstruction, for, you know, creating jobs, working jobs, paying taxes, and, you know, joining, you know, the reconstruction of this country and further post-war development. We do not know how many millions effectively fled forever, because many people start their own life in European nations and they feel fine about this, and they are not inclined to get back to Ukraine. And yeah, sometimes it doesn't work to adhere to their patriotic feelings when they essentially have a new life. So this is something that we talk about right now here in Ukraine. We have lost tens of thousands of soldiers, males and females. We have hundreds of thousands of disabled veterans right now. I'm seriously losing count of cases that I see each and every day as I collect information about disabled veterans that I can help with fundraising. It's a bottomless list, yes, of those amputees, heavy amputees, you know, sick disabled. It's an endless and a very painful wound that would affect us for decades to come, if not a century to come. And yes, this is not a feeling, this is just a fact, mathematical fact.
Yes. Well, Joyce writes, thank you so much for today's interview with Ilya Ponomarenko. He is so articulate, so intelligent, and like so many of us, so brave. Listening to him gives me hope for an independent and peaceful Ukraine in the future. This is a fundraising period for many public radio stations. You are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Well, this listener tweets, what is Ukraine's path to victory? Russia has many times the GDP and many times the population. They can afford to play the long game. And Steve on Discord writes, I think this is above all Putin's war. What will bring Putin to the table? What is his bare minimum to agree to peace? What can he not abide? What do you see as Ukraine's path to victory? Well, I think we may have lost the connection with Ilya briefly. And while we do that, let me see if I can bring caller Don into the conversation. Don, you're on.
Hello. Thank you. I want first to express my thanks and support to Ilya Ponomarenko and other Ukrainians on this forum. I want to apologize for Trump and MAGA Republicans who refuse to support Ukraine. I see the difficulty of conscripting soldiers to fight this war, and right now the policy of only using soldiers over the age of 27. I'm sure Ukraine needs many more, and I understand that they do not want to take away the young people's chance at college. I think, though, that it's an emergency. The country needs them. The U.S. And most other countries to their soldiers at the age of 18, and I definitely think that Ukraine should do that also. I also want to say that I'm a member of a commission. We are bringing six delegates from Ukraine in September, like we did last May. This time there will be members of the Ukrainian parliament. They will be meeting with people at Stanford and Hoover Institute. I very much want to see what that we can give a good, useful reception to these people. Mm. If Ilya is still there, I'd like to hear what he has to say, please.
Yes. Well, we are trying to see if we can establish the connection. Ilya is in Bucha, and so there's a little bit of a question with regard to whether or not we will be able to get him back. But I'll definitely note that for you, Don, and appreciate your efforts around all of this. Michael writes, I believe Mr. Ponomarenko in the Ukraine.
If I can send him an email?
Yes.
Can I email him? Can I?
Absolutely. And we'll one of our producers will make sure that you have his email information. Michael writes, I believe Mr. Ponomarenko and the Ukrainian people embody the highest ideals of America and the West, and their courage astonishes me on a daily basis. And Mike writes, I used to get Mr. Ponomarenko's updates on happenings in Ukraine on X and Twitter, but dramatically reduced my time on Twitter after Musk took over. I'm just hoping that he does not suffer reduced followership due to Musk's chaotic influence. Let me go next to caller Margie in San Francisco. Margie, how are you? What's on your mind?
So I work for a San Francisco-based NGO called the Center for Innovation, and we've been collaborating with a Ukrainian NGO called Dobrobot, which is a volunteer entity in Ukraine with 50,000 volunteers who are actually the people who go and restore houses, hospitals, and schools damaged by Russian shelling on a daily basis. So we're in conversation with them probably every other day or so about what's going on. And my question for Ilya is, I think it's an important part of the story about Ukrainian resilience, that such a massive scale of volunteer renovation and restoration is happening in the midst of daily war, particularly in areas hard hit like Kharkiv. And I just wanted to say that as an American based in San Francisco, how awe-inspiring this is to me about and what a narrative it tells of Ukrainian resilience. And I just wondered if you could comment on that.
Yeah. And again, unfortunately, we've lost our connection with Ilya, but I think your point is really well taken. And one of the things that Ilya does write about in his book is we were talking about, quote unquote, the hellscape of Bucha, which now has been rebuilt with Scandinavian style homes and grassy front lawns, thanks in part to some support from the United States. And that speaks to the hope and the resilience of Ukrainians who are trying to rebuild alongside the ongoing war. And I really appreciate you bringing that to our attention, Margie. My thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments for today's segment. My thanks to Caroline Smith for producing it. My thanks to Ilya Ponomarenko for his book, I Will Show You How It Was, The Story of Wartime Kyiv. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Support for Forum comes from San Francisco Opera. Set 10 years after a school shooting, the critically acclaimed opera Innocence takes us into a complex emotional journey where our understanding of innocence and guilt is constantly upended. Kaija Saariaho's ethereal score collapses the past into the present as a community of survivors grapple with how to move forward. Don't miss the highly anticipated American premiere of Innocence, June 1st through 21st. Learn more at sfopera.com.
We've all got those parts of our house where the internet just won't go. Well, if you had wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you could worry less about dead spots. Because with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity, you get fast speeds, reliable connection in every room, and power for all of your devices, even when everyone's online. That's wall-to-wall Wi-Fi, only with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
Did you ever wonder what it's like to live alone, hidden in the woods, not speaking to a single soul for 30 years? Or wander the desert, uncover a hidden well, and dive to the bottom of the deepest water hole for 2,000 miles? The Snap Judgment Podcast takes you there with amazing stories told by the people who live them, with an original soundscape that drops you directly into their shoes. Snap Judgment. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.